Look, I think you'd be, I'm a bit of a movie buff, and I think you'd be mistaken if, I don't know if you've heard of Quentin Tarantino. He's a interesting director. But he had a critically acclaimed movie called Reservoir Dogs. If you know anything about this movie, you'd be mistaken to think that reservoirs or dogs has anything to do with the movie. The title seems misleading, but it served to capture something of the story. And so does the Book of Joshua. Now, you may think the focus of the Book of Joshua is Joshua, but the title here is slightly misleading as it's actually not about Joshua. Now, don't get me wrong, he's the main lead in the character in the story, but he's neither the point or the main player in the story. And I need you to get your head around that. The Book of Joshua is about God. He's put front and center. What we do get in the Book of Joshua is how God interacts with his people, and in particular, Joshua. I explain that because I want you to feel the pattern and rhythm of this book, not just as a story about a man who overcomes great leadership sort of crisis, but as a God who is faithful through even our failures. So look with me, verse 1 in chapter 1. After the death of Moses, the Lord's servant, the Lord spoke to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' assistant. "Moses, my servant, is dead. Now you and all the people prepare to cross over the Jordan to the land I am giving the Israelites. I had given you every place where the sole of your foot treads, just as I promised Moses. Your territory will be from the wilderness and Lebanon to the great river, the Euphrates River, all the land of the Hittites and the west of the Mediterranean Sea." Look, once again, Charlton Heston once played the famous role of Moses in the Hollywood movie entitled The Ten Commandments. That isn't a joke. Hollywood once used to make biblical films, and it used to be one of the highest, most successful, highest grossing films at the time. Even Batman, Christian Bale, played Moses in the more recent Hollywood movie called Exodus, Gods and Kings. In other words, the story of Moses was and is epic. I mean, through the instruction of God, an 80-year-old shepherd confronts the most powerful man of the day, the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, and tells him to let my people go. Let the Israelites be free from slavery. And you can imagine how that went for Moses, a nobody asking Pharaoh to release his primary workforce and cheap labor. It didn't go well. Yet from some of the most wondrous signs and miracles witnessed in human history, Pharaoh eventually relents. Moses leads his people to freedom across a parted Red Sea to meet with God at the foot of a mountain, the mountain more sort of glorious than that of Mount Doom. It would make Mount Doom look like a splash and play park. And we see God time and time again provide for Israel in circumstances where they would have died otherwise. But Moses did incredible things. And it'd be easy to think, oh, Moses, he's the epitome of a true leader. And last week we sort of heard how Moses intervened with Israel in the book of Exodus, acted as the mediator. And you think, wow, Moses is a great leader. He's today still celebrated as Israel's greatest leaders, or one of them. He seems like a giant. And now as we begin this book with the reference that Moses is dead, the great servant of the Lord is no longer leading, you could think these are big shoes to fill. They were. Yet you'd be mistaken if you thought what made Moses a great leader was his character or people skills. You'd be wrong to think that what made Moses a great leader was his unique oratory skills, his education, his strength and courage. You'd be wrong to think that Moses was one of Israel's greatest leaders because he was brave and virtuous and he had integrity with all that he did. Moses failed in every single one of those fields. You see, what made Moses a great leader was God. The God who molded and shaped him, the God who wrestled with his heart, mind, and strength, the God who intervened and worked in and through Moses, even through his failures and disobedience. You see, what makes the story of Exodus so grand before we get to Joshua is that it was God who freed Israel. It was God who parted the seas. It was God who led them during the day in a pillar of smoke and at night in a pillar of fire. You remove God from the picture, and all you'd have is a weak, grumpy, 8-year-old geriatric who didn't want to go in the first place. There is a reason Moses is constantly referred to as the servant of the Lord. Notice it wasn't the other way around. God was never Moses' servant. What made Moses so significant, important, and the leader he became was because he was God's servant, no one else's. So with that in mind, you get Joshua, Moses' assistant, or his apprentice is probably a better way to capture it. Yes, there are some big shoes to fill. Yes, Joshua has an even bigger task of taking back God's promised land. Yet as this book starts, the confidence you place shouldn't be in Joshua. It isn't in Moses' legacy and training. It is in God and his promises. It is God who is giving Israel the land they can see. And it is God who will give Joshua the strength and courage to do it. Read with me. This is God continuing talking to Joshua. No one will be able to stand against you as long as you live. I will be with you just as I was with Moses. I will not leave you or abandon you. Be strong and courageous, for you will distribute the land I swore to their ancestors to give them as an inheritance. When God spoke to Joshua and told him to take the promised land, I want you to notice where Joshua's confidence is meant to be found in the task before him. Let me read it again very quickly. No one will be able to stand against you as long as you live. I will be with you, just as I was with Moses. I will not leave you or abandon you. Did you hear it? God is Joshua's confidence. Now, why does this matter? It matters because we often think what makes us good leaders, what gives us strength in a hostile, complex world, what makes us brave and courageous is human intuition, human power, human wisdom, human-centered philosophy and hope. Just muster enough sort of willpower and you'll be able to overcome any mountain. But that isn't how we're told to understand it from a biblical perspective, from God's perspective. Now, don't mishear me. Humans are created in God's image. We are his masterpieces in the vast universe of wonders and marvels. We can create and ponder and think. We can investigate and discover. We are wonderfully and fearfully made. Yet, the illusion we create in our world, the problem of sin, is thinking we can remove God from the equation and still achieve all those things. We think remove God from the narrative, that we don't need him, and we will make better gods than him. We can determine what is good and what is evil. Yet, brothers and sisters, friends, please don't think that as we look at our own history, that has gone really well for us. I would argue that the problem we face in our hearts is that you might not be an atheist or an agnostic, but we still struggle with the same sort of things, thought patterns and practices in our lives. We struggle with the same issues of building our lives and leading them with our own strength. We second guess our God. We act like functional atheists often. I wonder how many of you woke up this morning asking for God's strength to do anything today. I think we often get up and go, look, we've got to get this, we've got to do this. We are often so confident in our abilities than we are in trusting in a being we can't even see or comprehend. I don't care whether you've been following Jesus for years or you're new to the game or you don't even care about this, you've just been dragged here along this morning. The issue with our hearts is it's so easy to think that we can do this on our own. Joshua is given by God himself a task that no human could have achieved on his own. Yes, he had a nation behind him, but where he was about to be going into, the nations he was about to confront were far greater and more powerful than Israel. Israel had never trained for war. These nations made war a pastime. Is that me? Sorry. If it happens again, I'll make sure to not move too much. Yet for Joshua, as God gives him his task, we are confronted with a powerful statement that is either about mankind's triumph or God's glory. Let me read the repeated statement that God repeats often to Joshua. Look, God says, be strong and courageous. He repeats it right through. Be strong and courageous. And it's easy to think, isn't it? Oh, that's a beautiful, like it's a beautiful thing to say to someone. Oh, just be strong and courageous. But you would be mistaken if you thought what God was asking Joshua to do was search within and find that strength and courage. I mean, think about it for a moment. If Israel's about to confront nations and tribes that are greater in strength, power, military power, they're just more numerous than them. And God says, you know what? What I really want for you is just to be strong and courageous. What I want you to do is work out and train those glutes, do some bench presses. Like, you just work up those muscles, just be strong. And you know what, Joshua, you know what I want you to do is just to man up. Be courageous, be brave. Is that what God's doing to Joshua when he says be strong and courageous? He's entering it with a man-centered focus. You know what, you just need to be better. Well, if it is a man-centered approach, then verse 7 and 8 will be more curse than blessing. Because this is how God repeats the statement again. Above all, be strong and courageous to observe carefully the whole instruction my servant Moses commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you will have success wherever you go. This book of instruction must not depart from your mouth. You are to meditate on it day and night so that you may carefully observe everything written in it. From then you will prosper and succeed in whatever you do. You see, if we approach this with the lenses of, we can do it, just be strong and courageous, then keeping these instructions is near impossible. I mean, you try, okay, let's try this today. Let's just pick one. Let's pick anger for a moment. And I said to you, do not be angry. It's part of the Ten Commandments Moses given and the laws that are structured around. Do not curse your brother or sister. And then you get in the car and you drive down Ripley Road and someone cuts you off. Or you go to work and there's that incompetent, lazy work sort of co-worker. Or you try to talk to a difficult family member or a neighbor or children who don't want to listen and obey. And you try, just do not be angry. Just don't do it. Just be strong and courageous in the task ahead, and you do not be angry. Or try tomorrow not to covet, to not be jealous or envious or resentful of another person, of what they have or possess, what they're doing. You try scrolling through social media without that in mind, and you come back to me and tell me how you went. Imagine if all my advice was to you was, you know what? Just be strong and courageous. You go out and just follow and listen to God and it will just go so sweetly for you. And you come back to me and I go, Pastor, I failed. I found it really hard. And all I said to you was, you're just not strong and courageous enough. How'd that go for you, do you think? Pastor of the Year Award to 2023. Pierre, you're amazing. You're just pastoral skills. Just be strong and courageous. You see, none of it makes sense if we approach God's word with a man-centered lens. In other words, that the point of the narrative is me and me trying to muster up something from within. God is telling Joshua to find his strength and courage, not in himself, but in God. Actually, meditating on God's word pushes us this way. God ultimately reveals himself to us through his word, what he's like. It is through his word that we encounter what our hearts are like. It gives us a framework to understand what is going with our desires. What God wants in meditating on his word is to not lean on our own understanding, but God's. You see, at the heart of being strong and courageous is the question of who we trust to provide that strength and courage. Our trust in God, our faith in him, is what deepens our strength and courage, beloved. You see, we trust in his word, not only because it points us to him, but we understand through his word the one who can sustain us and empower us to do what our weak and frail and broken and sinful hearts can't. Being strong and courageous is trusting the one who, when you fail, is faithful and just to forgive you. Being strong and courageous is knowing that there is someone you can turn to when you feel afraid, discouraged, and just spent. Being strong and courageous is knowing who is with you, who is beside you, who's gone before you. It is why God finishes speaking to Joshua with these words. Haven't I commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or discouraged, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. I recently had an interesting moment with one of my children, I won't name them, who I had to pull a tooth out. So one of their teeth was growing and the other one was just clinging for dear life, but it had been months and the dentist had said, yeah, that needs to come out. Now this child is as good as an arguer and debater as me. So they had all the excuses, all the drama, and they wouldn't allow me to take the tooth out. It needed to come out, but they were scared, they were frightened. Like, they put on all the waterworks, they put all the, you know, oh, I'm just so scared of the pain, and, you know, lots of tears, and it'll break any parent's heart. But it was also a lot of drama. Gets it from my mother, I think. That is so not true if you know my wife. Anyways, the whole time, I'm pleading them to do what? To trust me. Now, I want to go in there and just go, look, just let me do it. But I'm wrestling with a heart. And eventually, through all the screaming and crying, they eventually let me do it. And as I finally, like almost getting my hand bit off, I pull out the tooth, lots of tears, lots of screaming and gasping, and it's so dramatic. I finally get the tooth out. And you know, one of the first things both Catherine and I said to this child was how brave you were. Now think about that for a moment. I know you're thinking, oh, Pierre, you should just be a dentist. No, I shouldn't. Or you might be thinking, she wasn't that brave. Well, she was, because they ended up trusting not in their strength, but in another strength to accomplish what they couldn't. Beloved, this is what is at the heart of being strong and courageous. It isn't to be the perfect Christian who nails life at every corner, twist and turn, but it's to trust in the one who is perfect, who is strong enough and brave enough to go before us, to be with us, to never leave us. You see, God keeps reminding Joshua, be strong and courageous, because he's trying to send to Joshua's focus not on himself but on another, on him. And this is what Joshua needs to grasp as he prepares for the task ahead of him. Read with me. Then Joshua commanded the officers of the people, go through the camp and tell the people, get provisions ready for yourselves, for within 3 days you'll be crossing the Jordan to go in and take possession of the land the Lord your God is giving you to inherit. Joshua said to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, remember what Moses, the Lord's servant, commanded you when he said, the Lord your God will give you rest and he will give you this land. Your wives, dependents, and livestock may remain in the land Moses gave you on this side of the Jordan, but your best soldiers must cross over in battle formation ahead of your brothers and help them until the Lord gives you your brothers rest, as he has given you. And they too possess the land the Lord your God is giving them. You may then return to the land of your inheritance and take possession of what Moses, the Lord's servant, gave you on the east side of the Jordan. You see, Joshua essentially prepares Israel to cross the River Jordan and to enter the Promised Land. Sorry, I was meant to put a map, but if they're entering it from the east and going into the west to the coast. And he does something quite profound, though, as he gathers the Israelites, and in particular the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, who historically, if he followed the narrative of Israel, didn't want to cross into the land originally. They were so frightened of what was laid across that sort of those seas that he was like, they were like, you know what? We'll just park it here. We're happy to have life here. And so they kind of rebelled and asked for land on the east side, where Moses, though angry and under God, relents and agrees with the clause that when the day comes for them to cross and take over the land on the west, that they would come too. And they agreed. But what is profound about what Joshua here does is that he points them back to the Lord. He reminds them that it was God's grace that enabled them to have the east of the Jordan. They didn't deserve it. It is God who will give them rest. They won't achieve it on themselves. And it will be God who will give them the land. Remember, Israel wasn't a nation of incredible sort of soldiers and warmongers. They were slaves for most of their lives. They were not given weapons. And so for them, Joshua is reminding that it will be God who wins the victory and it will be God who gives them the land. Joshua points them back to God's promises. He calls them to account, to trust in him, because behind those promises is the one who made them. You see, a promise is only ever as important and powerful as the person who made it. See, if my child made a promise, it's only as strong as they can achieve that promise. And if you don't know this, but the one who made these promises to Israel was the one who created the heavens and the earth. The one who made the stars, galaxies, and numerous suns, planets, and supernovas. It was the one who delivered on a promise made to another 90-year-old man who was dead by all accounts, Abraham and his wife Sarah, who was barren, that they would be a family as numerous as the stars. It was God that achieved that. Joshua is pointing them to the one who delivered Israel with great signs and wonders, parting the seas, bringing water from rock, food from the skies and ground. Joshua is pointing them back to God. Can I do that now for you? I don't know your story. I don't know how God has worked in your life. Or you may think God hasn't ever worked in your life. But can I point you that there is someone trustworthy when it comes to promises? You see, this God, the God of the universe, makes a promise and he keeps it. The book of Joshua is really that God promising, fulfilling his promise and showing his people that despite their failures, despite them not holding their end of the bargain, God is not like them. God is not like us. You see, what made it worth it for Moses? I don't know if you know Moses' story, but he eventually stuffs it as well. And God says, you will never enter the promised land. And for 40 years, he travels with grumbling, complaining people, only to die looking at the promised land. What made it worth it? His trust in God. The trust he had in his promises. That though he would not taste the fruit of this land, he knew God had promised him something better. Let me explain what I mean. Read with me verse 16. They answered Joshua, that is, the Reubenites, Gadites, and Manasseh. Everything you have commanded us, we will do. And everywhere you send us, we will go. We will obey you just as we obeyed Moses in everything. Certainly the Lord your God will be with you as he was with Moses. Anyone who rebels against your order and does not obey your words in all that you command him will be put to death. Above all, be strong and courageous. I don't know if you've ever did this as a kid, and I sort of mentioned it earlier, but I remember I'd do something wrong or I wanted something and I'll tell my parents, I promise I'll never do it again. You know, my mum would be like, oh, look, you haven't fixed your room. You can't go to your mate's place. I'd go, oh, mum, I'll clean it now and I promise never to make my room messy again. I don't know about you. Maybe you were so much better than me at this. I never kept that promise. I used to always make these promises when I did something wrong and I got caught out that I would never do it again. I'll never disobey, mum. Like, even if there's a whiff of rebellion in my heart, mum, I will crush it and I will obey you perfectly. My mum would see, you could ask her how that goes. Well, classic Israel makes the same promise, or same type of promise. Listen again. Everything you command us, we will do, Joshua. And everywhere you send us, we will go. We will obey you, just as we obeyed Moses in everything. Now, quick history lesson. How good was Israel at obeying? I'll give you two options. A, they nailed it. Listened to everything Moses said and obeyed him in everything. Or B, they sucked at it. They disobeyed, they grumbled, they complained, and even rebelled. Which is it, A or B? Did you say nailed it? No, stuffed it. B, they didn't. I mean, like, it's so interesting. God will part the sea for them, lead them through an impossibility to save them. And the next day, they will make the claim, oh, God, you freed us in order to kill us. Yeah, that's exactly what God was doing the whole time. He would do signs and wonders to get you to the other side, to free you and destroy Egypt in order to kill you. So the irony can't be missed when those very same people say this. Anyone who rebels against your order and does not obey your words in all that you command him will be put to death. You see, this story, if it was about the triumph of man, would be a depressing story. But again, I remind you that this story, this book, isn't about us, but about God and his glory. It is about the God who makes wondrous promises and keeps them despite our human failure and sin. You see, God knew the moment that he made those promises that Israel would fail, that they would not be able to keep them. And from a human perspective, you would be right to ask them, what was the point of the man? But this is a divine act because God promised. God made those promises to them in order to show them who he is and who we are in the light of it. God is graciously, tenderly, lovingly helping us to trust him. You see, the promise, the story of Joshua. Actually, does anyone know what Joshua means? It means God saves. Does anyone know what Jesus' name is? Yeshua. God saves. All of it was pointing to a bigger and better promise. The reality is that we have all failed. We have all rebelled against God. We all deserve death, if you like. We have all tried to do life apart from the life giver. And yet God, instead of abandoning us, forgetting us, destroying us, promises that he will fulfill something greater. You see, he promised Moses that there'll be a greater prophet than him, a more glorious savior and deliverer than Joshua, a better king than David. God promised time and time again to the leaders of Israel that there would be one that is better than all of you, that there would be a servant of the Lord who is a true servant of the Lord, of one who came not to be served but to serve others and ransom their lives. That there would be a better leader who would destroy the greatest threat and enemy, sin and death. that this leader would lead us to a better land, a better promise, not of just physical land, but an eternal one. We heard it as Tom read it to us this morning. And that this in promise is for all nations, every tribe, tongue, and nation, from every corner and age of the earth. And God does send that better servant, that better leader, that better deliverer. And he fulfills a better promise. Jesus came and he deals with the threat of sin and death. He does it by entering into the world that he created to be the leader that we needed. A king who didn't come with romp and pomp, but with humility and sacrifice. Like, I don't know if you've read just what needs to go on for the coronation of King Charles. Jesus didn't need any of it. And this king came to die, not for his sins or mistake, but for ours. That he is the Christ, the Messiah, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And this king says, all you need to inherit all that he gains, new life, being freed from sin and death, being part of God's family, forever loved. What he offers isn't that you become the strongest or wisest or the bravest and then you can be part of it. It isn't dependent upon your race or your gender or your age or your achievements. All the king asks is to trust him. Trust in the one who is strong and courageous. Beloved friends, can I implore you that our trust in the Lord isn't a weak and insignificant thing. It is profound and powerful. Because when we trust the King, you will see that he can do more wonders than you imagine. That when you trust the King, you're entering into a relationship, not a transaction. You are entering into one who promises to remain with you and who is mightier than all the nations, stronger than death, and more powerful than our sin. The one who holds you, loves you, is with you, and will never break his promise. So, beloved friends, above all, be strong and courageous. Let me pray.